once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill up the wall with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring
Jeff
and Jake
McClure.
And we did it.
We did it.
Said our names. Wow. Oh, my goodness. Oh, we're so excited we can say our names. In unison. It's a little hard.
A collective 110 years of practice. And we finally got to where we can say our names together.
Yes, sometimes. Enough so that when we do it, we celebrate. It's amazing. So we are the Personal Wealth Coach. Not only do we try to be in sync with our voices, with often failure being the outcome, but sometimes success, we also offer views, opinions, facts on the economy, on finance, all that good stuff. But before we get started on that, we have some disclosures that we need to do. Would you like to begin? He's going to tell.
Let's see. What do we be? Oh, yes. I can begin with the fact that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of a radio program, it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisor based in Salado, Texas. And the two guys here are also principals at the investment advisor. But the fact that I said SEC at the beginning has no meaning. It does not mean, does not yet has meaning. It means that we're registered with the SEC. It's just that the SEC neither approves nor disapproves of anything we do. Well, they will be ready to disapprove, but they never really approve of anything that we do.
Right. I'm gonna lower your volume and call you right back as well. You've got that through, but you're clicking and our connection's not good. So I'm gonna continue the disclosures. We, as he said, registered with the SEC, but that doesn't mean that they give us a thumbs up on anything. In fact, the opposite is always the case, in that the Securities and Exchange Commission does not advocate for anyone. They advocate for the public, not for companies. So this is for their good. All right. Can you hear me better now, or can I hear you better?
I can hear you just fine.
Perfect. You're not popping anymore. So you want to give the deem?
The information that we present on this educational, not advisory program, even though it is the Personal Wealth Coach, we're not actually trying to coach you as to wealth. We're not giving investment advice.
We're giving
the
education.
The information we give, right. The educational information that we provide on this radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of said information.
There you go. Now you have been very thoroughly legalistic. We're not guaranteeing anything. We're not warranting anything, but we're going to say it anyway.
we could say investment values may be higher or lower when purchased and sold.
Or sold. Or even if they're not purchased and sold.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe. No.
Will be. They will be different.
If it's an investment, it will be.
Yeah. All right. And let's see. We've got another one. We don't pay for this radio program. We're not paid to do the radio program. We do advertise on the radio station for the program, but so does the radio station. So we're in partnership in advertising it, but we don't pay for it. We've been doing this for a long time. Elder Baldy, is that more respectful, responsible for having started this radio program back in 1996, which some of the listeners weren't born yet. And that doesn't...
Is that the boys and girls?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that long ago to me, but I do remember, I joined in 98, and I remember talking to people about the Y2K bug and talking to people about, what that meant and trying to help people figure out how to find the at symbol on their keyboard so that they could send an email properly on the
air. Or the any key. Don't forget the any key.
Or the any key, yes. So times have changed a lot during that time period. Time has changed during time. Yes. And that is a truth. Time changes over time. The future is just not what it used to be, as Yogi Berra said. So all that is to say, we've had a lot of experience in messing up and doing it right, and we would prefer to do the latter to the former when possible. So hopefully you can learn from our experience. What happened this week in the market?
Well, the S&P 500 stock index closed at 4,500.53. And I say that up front and notably because I really like it when the S&P 500 has a nice round number like 4,500. Because you can benchmark and say, okay, it was at 45. I remember when it was at 4,500.
Why don't people use crazy random numbers for their milestones? You remember when the S&P 500 broke through 4,321.73?
It's kind of like the date last week that I will remember.
2-22-22?
02-02-2022.
Right.
And we won't get another one of those like that
for
1,000 years.
But when we get to the 22nd of this month, we'll get 02-22-2022.
Right. That's not quite as good as
02-02. I don't know. I like it. See this
02-22.
This quibble between who prefers what number order, round numbers, repeating numbers. Headlines understand this stuff. And so we had a headline number of 4,500. Which is pretty awesome.
Right. So we had 4,500.53 to be exact. It was up 1.55% for the week. Now, if you weren't following anything that happened in the market news during the week, you would say, okay, well, okay, that's nice. What's special about that?
Well, there was a according to the news, people were being slaughtered left and right. There was pandemonium, explosions, and other nasty things happening.
And we had the greatest loss of value in a single stock in the history of the stock market last week.
In a single day.
This week, in a single day. And we had the greatest gain in the value
of a stock,
the stock market in a single day.
They weren't the same stock.
Days right next to each other.
Right. Yeah. They were different stocks.
Meta, which used to be formerly called Facebook, had the greatest loss of value in a single day ever seen in the stock market. And the next day, Amazon had the greatest gain in absolute value that we've seen.
When do you think Amazon's going to change their name? I mean, Google became Alphabet. We got Facebook becoming Meta. Apple hasn't really changed. They changed their logo to have a bite out of it.
You know why?
Because Apple Music was the Beatles record production company, and they got sued for copyright infringement. And so they responded in legal court.
Trademark
infringement. And so they responded by saying, we will never get into the music business, which they have since forgotten about and have gotten.
Well, they took a bite out of the apple.
Yeah. That makes a big part of it. It's no longer trademark because there's a bite out of the apple.
Which, by the way, upset certain people who are biblical oriented.
Yeah. Well, except it wasn't an apple in the biblical story.
Yeah, but they think it was. There's no apple mentioned in Genesis, but that's beside the point.
So all of this is quibbling, and that's what the stock market did all week.
The 4,500 number was up 1.55% for the week, and it was really a crazy week up and down with panic and panic buy. There was both panic buying on Friday and panic selling on Wednesday. So that's the way the market's going. The market, the S&P 500 is still down 5.57% this year, which sounds terrible, but it's up 15.79% from last year at this time. It's up 101.15% from, if you have really long memory, and you can think back all the way to 2020, in the spring of 2020, when the market was collapsing and the world was coming to an end, and the newspaper was saying, and the television stations, the internet television stations were saying, bail out, now the world is coming to an end, or something like that. Well, it's up 101.15% from there. So that's what's going on. And we follow another index. And it's an important index because it's a value index, whereas the S&P 500 tends to lean towards growth stocks. Growth stocks are the value is based on what people think, the consensus of what people think earnings will be in the future from that company, whereas value stocks are generally tend to be based on the intrinsic value of the company. The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index closed the week at 2,528.85. That's up 1.4%. But importantly, it's only down 2.63% this year. And we monitor that for a reason. One thing, there seems to be a shift going on, rotation it's called, from large cap growth stocks, which are the high flyers that make the headlines, like Facebook and Amazon. And it seems to be that the market sentiment is shifting over towards smaller stocks, which is why we like to look at mid-cap, which is not large cap. It's smaller than mid-cap. That's good. And value. So mid-cap value, we're tracking to see just exactly how much the shift is going on. And so far, the last year, the shift has been notable, and we continue to follow that. The other side of the market, the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, and it did really well. It's sort of the yield on it did well. If you were holding notes, if you're holding bonds, you're probably really unhappy. I'm just looking at the Morningstar's total bond market index. It's down 3% this year. It was down 1.something% last year when the stock market was up. So basically, you're down. If you held the something that emulated or came close to emulating the total bond market index, that particular investment is probably down about 5% over the last 2 years. But the reason it went down is because interest rates went up. And the 10-year note, which is kind of the benchmark for all this, the treasury note.
Treasury note, yeah.
Yeah. Is up, it's yielding 1.913%. Now let's compare that. Last year, at the beginning of the year, beginning of 2021, it was yielding 0.91%. So it is, well, the interest, the yield on it has more than doubled, which means if you were holding a 10-year treasury note at the beginning of last year and you own one and you looked at the market value today, it would be substantially lower. So that's what's going on in the bond market. The 30-year note did rise, the 30-year bond, treasury bond, rose to up to 2.214. And the important thing here is to note that at one end of the treasury yield curve, the short end, at 90 days, the yield is 0.025. It's little. It's a very tiny yield, almost zero on a 90-day T-bill. And it goes to 1.91% at 10 years and 2.214% at the other end, which means it's a steep curve, fairly steep curve. It goes from almost zero to 2.214%. The thing to watch out for in the bond market, particularly as far as the whole economy is concerned, is if the short-term 90-day T-bill or two-year or five-year was paying more interest, it had a higher yield than the 20 or 30-year notes and bonds. That's called an inverted yield curve and generally means batten down the hatches, there's a recession on the way.
We're not seeing that at all, though.
We're seeing the reverse of that, and it's important to keep an eye on the whole thing.
Let me interject something here. We're educating, so let's do that real quick. There's a vast amount of confusion in the bond market or about the bond market. Most people don't understand it at all. So I'm going to give a very quick kind of big chief tablet with a crayon explanation, because the simpleness of it is what we should be focused on. The bond market is just a bunch of loans. You can think of it as any loan you want. The short ones are called bills. And the middle range ones are called notes. And the long range ones are called bonds. So if it's a bill, it's something you pay and you're done with every month, like your electric bill. You pay it off. You pay it off every month. That's short term. A note is something that it's like a reminder to pay this every month into the future. It's a different amount being, it's the same amount being paid every month into the future, where your electric bill is going to change every month. Okay, now go out to the bond. If you're way out there, you need to be like really promising to pay this back, and your word is your bond. So the long-term ones are bonds, and they tend to have higher interest rates. And the short-term ones are bills, like your electric bill. The ones in the middle are the notes. So people throw those words around, and most people don't know the difference. So I'm giving the easiest way to remember it that I can. Okay, right. Now on the to other, the next part.
The other thing we follow in markets is the price of oil, because it's another indicator about what's going on out there. And that takes a little bit of analysis to figure out why the price goes up and down. But the price of oil joined in. It rose 5.32% to $91.93 a barrel, which kind of confirms what we were talking about last week. There's the people who follow this very carefully and have good records on being able to see what's happening in the future are suggesting we're going to have $100 per barrel oil by this summer. And I think we're getting close enough that that's probably true. Why?
Ukraine and shipping issues and fracking issues and
those are there. Kazakhstan is there. There's some risks out there. But the primary reason, at least according to the analysts that I've read, that the price of oil crept up this week and crept up the week before, the rise this week was driven by the employment report. You can see the price of oil jump right after the employment report comes out. Now, why does employment affect the price of oil? Because we created far more jobs, and we'll get into that in the rest of the program. That's probably the biggest subject of the day.
Yeah, big part.
We created the consensus among economists was that we were going to lose 150,000 jobs in January in the United States, and we gained 467,000 jobs instead. And then they ratcheted up November and December's numbers. So that the United States basically created in the last 3 months a million new employees.
Now I'm gonna go completely in character here and say and pat ourselves on the back. Ow! I just wrenched my shoulder out of socket. Ow! Okay, because we predicted job growth in January, big job growth. We said this is going to continue through. And you can go back and listen to us talk about it in December and at the beginning of the month in December. We had some reruns play toward the end of the month. But we're talking about job growth ahead in January and February because we couldn't see how it wouldn't happen even with Omicron on the rise at that point. Now it's on the drop.
The other thing was in the newsletter that we talked about was the fact that the unemployment and the job growth numbers in November and December were so out of whack, we felt the job growth numbers were way too low. And we gave an estimate of about 780,000 more jobs were created than the Labor Department was able to count. And sure enough, that's about what it boils down to. The bottom line to it is, in the last 90 days, and there's another thing that happened in the last 90 days that's pretty impressive concerning labor we'll get into about productivity. But in the last 90 days, the United States, the economy of the United States employed at least a million more people than it did the previous quarter. We added a million new filled jobs in the United States in the last 90 days, ending at the end of January. That is just phenomenal. Now, interestingly enough, the unemployment rate went up from 3.9 to 4. So why, if we're adding so many jobs and so many people are being hired, why did the unemployment rate go up? Well, the reason is the participation rate went up too. Apparently, now that wages are starting up and they rose about 5.7% last year on average, we're seeing a lot of people who are saying, I think I'll go to work now. And the other thing is the Omicron beginning to fade on the East Coast is a plus. So people are beginning to think thing is over. Maybe they're just tired of not working.
It's fading here too.
Right.
I've had meetings this week and talked with a whole series of people, and the numbers of people hospitalized in Central Texas is dropping as well. So most of the places that have already felt the really nasty impact, a really high impact of this extra virulent strain are getting better now. And the places that are just beginning to experience it are still on the upward rise. So more of the rural area is getting hit later. So the less metropolitan hospitals are still seeing upticks in hospital admissions, but the big cities are starting to see the drops in admission. Their deaths are going up, unfortunately, but there's a lag on that.
All right. Well, that's kind of the market.
We've got.
And by the way,
go ahead.
Concerning the market, I know there's a lot of angst out there.
Mm-hmm.
But and there's certainly several mostly perma beers who are saying this is a bubble and it's going to collapse.
Wait, did you guys say who are saying perma beer?
Perma bears.
Perma bear. Okay, I was thinking they're perma beer. That sounds really good, actually.
They're perma bears. They're always Jeremy Grantham and several other people who continually say the market is phenomenally overpriced and is due for a crash are saying it's due for a crash, and they're getting headlines because the market wobbled around this last week. It just ain't in the cards, folks. There's a lot of things that will cause the stock market to crash. But the bottom line to the stock market, and this is something that John Templeton harped on for a long time, and I completely
totally agree.
Agree with him, is that it is an issue of supply and demand. It's that simple. If people have cash and the stock market looks like it will probably pay them back better than someplace else where they could put their money for 10 years or so, odds are the stock market has room to go up. It may bounce around. It may fluctuate. It may do a lot of things, but it's unlikely to crash. And one of the key ways of looking at this, and I've seen it in the short term, it doesn't mean a lot. In the long term, it means quite a bit. You look at the earnings yield at any given moment on the S&P 500 stock index, which you can just type in earnings yield S&P 500 stock index in Google, compared with the 10-year treasury yield. Consistently over time, if the earnings yield in the S&P 500 is higher than the earnings yield than the interest yield on the 10-year treasury, we have room to see the market go up. When that reverses, if you ever want a time that batting down the hatches and thinking, okay, I got to get my cash reserves built up, don't bail out of the market, don't try to time it. But you definitely want to be concerned when you see those reverse. It's kind of like the yield curve. When you see those numbers reverse, where you can get more interest by owning a 10-year treasury bond than you can get earnings yield out of the S&P 500, we're on shaky ground.
Yeah.
Just something to mark down in your book someplace.
We have a couple of questions waiting for us out there. Do you want to move to those next?
Sure.
Our most loyal questioner, Inquisitor John, has two questions out there. The first
one.
Oh,
by the way,
go ahead.
Did we give out our email addresses?
No, we should. The email address is, if you want to ask questions or make observations or call us names, please make them Jake and Jeff rather than other names. Our Jeff at tpwc.com, as in Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach, or Jake at tpwc.com. And we actually read those things. So send them in. We'll look at them. If it's something relevant to the program and not sports related, we'll actually cover it. Probably.
Sometimes we talk about sports a little bit.
Yeah.
Not much.
Just to show our ignorance, and the depth of our ignorance is massive.
It's unplumbable.
Yes. The question, first question, subject is jobs, jobs, jobs.
Steve.
He's dead. Not Steve. He's dead. Yeah.
Oh.
His question is, or statement, Wall Street Journal said a week or so ago that the U.S. is at full employment, yet it's reported that there are 10 million jobs available. It seems that every time a positive jobs number is released, the market falls. Please explain all this in layman's terms. Can I hit full employment and you want to handle the rest of the question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, full employment.
This is exciting. It's a good question.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's like a multifaceted good question, because the term full employment is almost a joke amongst economists. It's like saying the ocean level is full. What does that even mean? Because we're still having new babies. So full employment in 1960 is not full employment in 1961 or even in January to February. It has a lot to do with workplace participation. So full employment is an imaginary concept that doesn't actually ever happen. There's no such thing unless everyone that is able to pick up anything is working. Full employment is going to have all kinds of disclaimers, meaning those above the age of 18 to 54 or and so on. So full employment is used almost as a layman's term to say, hey, we've got the most number of people. Everybody that wants a job has a job, basically. And I don't know, all the times that I've heard that term being used, I have personally known people that were looking for jobs during those periods. So just keep in mind, full employment is aspirational. We never, ever are going to be there. Go ahead. Now you can get the rest.
Full employment from an economics point of view, it varies over time, and we become more efficient. So full employment is a lower unemployment rate.
Right.
But at any given moment, there are people who are quitting, people who, for whatever reason, the company shut down for whatever reason. There's a certain minimum number of unemployed people out there looking for work at any given moment. Just like the housing market right now, we call it saturated. Basically, it means that there's just basically, we would say we've got full buying in the housing market, where there's just should be no empty houses sitting around waiting for somebody. But in fact, there's a certain small percentage of houses on the market at any given moment. So even though we have the housing market fully employed, if you will, there's still going to be a few unoccupied houses on the market for a short period of time. There's still going to be some people out of work for whatever reason for a short period of time that are considered to be unemployed. By the way, the definition of unemployed is important.
Yeah.
It means you've looked for work in the last 90 days, but you're not currently working. That's all it means. Yeah. And there's going to be a small number of people who've looked for work in the last 90 days that currently don't have a job. The question is whether years and years ago, when I first learned economics, basically, full employment was 4%.
Yeah, I remember that. I actually remember a time when they said full employment was 6%.
Yeah. That was earlier in my career.
Right. That was early enough that I read about it, and the people teaching on the subject laughed like, oh, how could they think that? When the reality is that really was as full as we'd gotten for a long time, so they called it full.
And one of the reasons it's come down is because of the internet.
Yeah.
Basically, job seekers and people who want to hire can get together much more efficiently now than they could in the past. So 4% is still generally considered to be pretty much full employment. Yes, we got down to 3.5.
I wish they would.
Before the pandemic.
I wish that we could just change that to pretty much full employment, but that's not soundbite worthy. So I think it's soundbite. I'm going to say pretty much full employee.
Yeah, but Microsoft Word would underline it red if you said pretty much in front of full employment.
We're going to say from now on, we have officially reached pretty much full employment, and it just doesn't sound so official, but it's true.
So there's a reason that the market goes down when employment goes up.
Yes.
It doesn't always, by the way. The Federal Reserve is charged to do two things. It's charged to maintain the value of money, and it's also charged to achieve full employment.
It has a third piece in there that is a less priority, but in the same thing to protect employment, and that is to calm the marketplace.
Right. So the opioid epidemic should probably be blamed on the Federal Reserve.
Federal Reserve needs to get more involved in the opioid epidemic immediately.
So the issue is that when there's a really good employment number, like we just saw, it causes the market to dip a little bit, as it did late Friday, because full employment, we're pretty much at full employment, which means the Federal Reserve has no legitimate reason to keep interest rates low and keep pumping money into the economy anymore. We've got inflation down, which is maintaining the value of the currency. But they allowed inflation to go back up again, and now they've got to beat inflation down, which means they're going to raise interest rates. If employment gets too high, theoretically, they would raise interest rates over that too. So the concern is that if the economy is running too hot, the Federal Reserve has an obligation to slow it down. And if they start slowing it down, they're going to raise interest rates, which is going to impact certain stocks, which leads us to John's other question.
Well, do you mind if I hit just one more piece on that?
Right.
Just to hit all the pieces of it.
Are you piece hitting?
I just think pieces just needs to be hit. Yeah.
That's better than pinch hitting.
Yeah.
That'd be painful.
I don't know how to pinch and hit at the same, but yeah, they do it in sports occasionally. It seems like it'd be against the rules, but anyway, employment's a lagging indicator. Sometimes, very rarely, it's a concurrent indicator. And I love the word concurrent because it means the same thing as current. And we're getting reports that the KTEM Listen Live is not working online. They had a power outage earlier, and I'm not sure if it's back up and running. So online may not be listening except through podcasts later. Anyway, back to concurrent and current. That just means a present indicator versus one that happened already. Let me explain that a little bit. Let's go layman. If you're a small business owner and things are going really well for you right now, you've got a lot of money in the bank, you start saying, hey, I need some help. I need to start hiring people. Generally speaking, if you're doing the same level of well you did last month or the month before, you haven't raised your earnings at all, you're not saying I need to hire a bunch of new people. So that decision to hire generally comes after you've already had earnings go up. The exception to that is in things like natural disasters and war, like what happened in March and April of 2020, the pandemic hit and it was a concurrent indicator. The labor market dropped because a lot of people got laid off right then. And it was a signal of what was happening at that very moment. But it is in no way a leading indicator. What's more, when you hire somebody, everybody's productivity goes down. This is true no matter what the business. Unless you're hiring somebody that's already worked for you, they've got to be trained. And the people that are capable of training are probably the people that are the best at doing the job, which means they're not doing the job when they're training, and therefore they've got two people doing less work than one person was doing. You can see productivity hit there. It has to happen as part of the growing pains of handling new business. You've got to train people before you go forward. But that's another reason why the market might drop on employment news being so good, because productivity has been going up really well for the last 2 years. We're starting to see that drop as new people are coming in and we're just hiring anybody we can grab because there's so few people looking for jobs. Productivity's dropping and you've got more.
Well, productivity is another question. Productivity last quarter was up 6.6%.
Yeah, we had a huge uptick. But when you have a massive amount of hiring, you can expect that to drop.
Well, sometimes.
Sometimes. I agree.
And the reason is that if they're hiring, we don't know who they're hiring. If they're hiring back people who already know what they're doing.
Which is not the case probably anymore. It probably was before, but we'll see. Yeah, go ahead.
But that was the other. We will talk about that. Okay. KTM is back online.
Woo-hoo.
A couple of minutes ago.
Okay. Good.
Thank you, Jim. The other thing he asked about, and he asked about rate hike and value investing, which I think is a very insightful question, John. Why would higher interest rates cause growth stocks to fall? And it has, by the way. If you look at the highest growth stocks out there on average, the average high growth, large cap growth company stock in the S&P 500, some of those things are down in bear market territory right now. Meanwhile, and we pointed that out when we were talking about markets a little earlier, slightly smaller stocks, mid-cap, in the value sector have done exceptionally well over the last year as interest rates, as the rumors of interest rates and the story of interest rates rising and so on has come on board. The reason is, if you talk about, you think about a company that's growing really, really fast, and I don't mean the stock price is growing really, really fast. I mean, the company itself is growing really, really fast.
They're hiring people, they're buying equipment, they're buying real estate.
Some of those companies have literally no earnings. Remember, Tesla had no earnings for a long time. Shoot, Amazon had no earnings for a long time. They're reinvesting all of their money, but they're growing faster than their revenue. Where are they getting the money to grow faster than their revenue grows? And the answer is they borrow it. And when they can borrow it at very, very, very low interest rates, it isn't hard for them to reach a profitability point and then have their profit jump down the road. Tesla is a wonderful company, but is running, it has a huge, relative to the size of the physical size of the company, I'm not talking about the stock value, it has a huge debt. I mean, Elon Musk may have billions of dollars, but he's borrowed more billions than he has. I say he, it's the company that's actually borrowed it.
Yeah.
To build their new plants and to spool up production. And the more money they borrow, the greater the interest rate load they have. But as long as interest rates, and they have been, for the money they're borrowing are lower than inflation, in essence, the banks are paying Tesla and all these other companies to borrow money. Now, if interest rates start up, and a lot of these business loans, by the way, roll over every 90 days or sometimes every 30 days. They roll over and get a new interest rate in a short period of time. It's kind of like if you've ever built a house from scratch and you get what's called a bridge loan to build the house, that interest rate you commonly resets as often as once a month. So if interest rates go up, it becomes more expensive for these companies that have great promise but not a lot of revenue to do well. And even the ones with a lot of revenue, if they've got a lot of borrowing going on, it becomes more expensive for them to do business as long as they're subsisting on borrowed money. So what that does is it cuts into their future earnings. And since the price of those high growth stocks is based on a calculation of the present value of their future earnings, I know that sounds a little esoteric, but basically how much are those future earnings worth today is based on interest rates. The higher interest rates go, the lower the present value of those stocks go, and the more sophisticated investors start to sell them. And when they start to sell them, the people who aren't sophisticated see the price go down, so then they pile on and sell too, and the market overreacts.
Yeah. So let me give this a different way, because obviously venture capital is also another place that these startup companies can get money other than just borrowing it. So Tesla, Apple, Facebook, Meta now, all of these folks received a lot of venture capital money. Well, the venture capital money is a lot easier to get when interest rates are down, because that money can go into long-term bonds if interest rates are really good and they don't have to take any risk. So venture capital gets money easier during low interest rates, the same way that companies get money easier during lower interest rate. And this is why raising interest rates makes money harder to acquire. It's more expensive, which can lower inflation. This is why the Federal Reserve is talking about raising interest rates.
To finish off John's question, and we're about out of time before we need to do commercials. To finish off John's question, how does that help value stocks? Well, value companies are mostly, now this is not 100% true, but they're mostly in a position where they are paying as they go. Their revenue and everything, they don't have a lot of loans on them, or they wouldn't be value stocks. They haven't got a lot of money borrowed. Our business, for example, has very little money borrowed, next to no money borrowed, and as a result would be considered, if we were a corporation, would be a value stock. And value stocks over the long term, and when I talk about long term, I'm talking about decades here, tend to outperform growth stocks. As crazy as that sounds, over the long, long term, historically, value stocks have outperformed growth stocks. So when interest rates start back up to normal, again, this is based on historical evidence, growth stocks tend to not do as well when interest rates rise, and value stocks tend to take the lead in the market.
I've seen a lot of statistics on this. The one that seems to be the most trusted is that 9 out of 10 small growth companies fail before they make it up into the mid-cap category, because they came up with a technology. I mean, think about when PayPal was purchased by eBay, which was the beginning of Elon Musk's fortune. They were in competition with about 14 other companies that were nearly identical to PayPal. And it was simply eBay choosing PayPal over the others that caused Elon Musk's fortune to jump. So keep that in mind as we go along as well. That growth companies, if 1 out of 14 or 15 is still around from that period, that's a good definition. Now, that one company and the companies that followed after had amazing earnings, and people hear about this, you know, they really hit it big. It's those other ones that you don't really hear about anymore. Where in the value companies, they're trying to maintain a profit. They're not trying to grow over rapidly. They're trying to maintain the value of their assets.
There's even an element of that in the market now called pick and shovel. I don't know if you heard of that. It's a group of in the gold rushes, for instance, the California gold rush, the people who made the big fortunes were not the people who found gold. The people who made the big fortunes are the people who showed up with picks and shovels to sell to the people who were looking for gold. And if you think of the pick and shovel hardware company as being a value company, and the rising gold mining companies all over the place in California during the gold rush as being growth companies, that kind of outlines it. One's kind of boring, and the other one's exciting, and the boring people actually wound up making more money than the exciting people.
NVIDIA selling GPUs, graphic processing units, to the crypto miners. That's an, and we've got to play some commercials. Yeah. If you guys would like to talk to us during this episode or have us talk about it later, give us an email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we'll be back on the other side of these very important messages from our sponsors.
Ta-da!
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We said it again. Ladies and gentlemen, we have twice in a single hour said our names together in unison without messing it up. We have things to celebrate. All right. So what's your next subject?
I
got a lot of headlines that we could hit.
Actually, I had another subject, and if I can remember what it was, I was about to talk about. Oh,
I'll give you a quick one if you're still organizing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got why Facebook fell on its face.
Meta fell on its Facebook.
Well, Meta fell on its face because of Facebook.
Right.
And it was I think it should merge
with MySpace and become MyFace.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Anyway. There's a bit of wisdom I read about that, and the headline on it was, don't build your house on somebody else's property.
Why not? How could that go wrong?
Facebook, which is the number one moneymaker for Meta, it's the only moneymaker for Meta, made a pivot a couple of years ago, or a few years ago, from primarily being based on computers to being based on the iPhone. Now, I know it's also available on Android and other things like that. But basically, it was considered a mark of genius at the time, and that's when the stock price started really soaring, is they redesigned Facebook so that it would look good on a smartphone. And they depended on something, and that is that Apple would allow them access to the data from people from smartphones, choosing various ads and doing things so that they could focus their advertising on what people appeared to be interested in,
right?
Which made things work a lot better, and they could charge a lot more for advertising. And they also did a lot of other stuff that we don't like putting a lot of advertisements on Facebook.
Well, that's how they make their money.
But well, more of the advertisements than they would before.
Right.
Anyway, the problem really boils down to the fact is Apple decided, whether it was decided for them elsewhere, it was decided in Europe and other things in advance, but Apple didn't wait to get sued like Facebook did. Apple decided that their subscribers' privacy was considerably more important, so they restricted the use and the availability of the data about what you were doing on your iPhone from going to Facebook. And all of a sudden, Facebook's ads became less ability to, they had less ability to target. They had less ability to follow you around the internet. A lot less, by the way. And it really hurt them.
Can I give a quick family story on this?
Sure. And I want to give the opposite side of that too. Just go ahead.
Your son and my brother was the founder or co-founder of a music industry tech startup that went from nothing to ginormous in a very short period of time. I gave a lot of advice and so on with them. But at one of the big launches for the software, which made an app for a band to be hosted on the App Store. So each band was having an app made for them by this new company. And so I have some pretty in-depth knowledge on it. And it was a big deal. This is 2011. The iPhone was the only smartphone. Android was starting to come out, and Google was really owning the Android field because that was their operating system. So a lot of their ad revenue was going in there. And during one of the launches, I got to sit in a meeting with, I'm not going to say the names of the executives, but on the phone was a deceased executive from Apple.
On the phone? He was on the phone?
He wasn't deceased at the time.
Oh, I started to say, you had a dead person on the phone? That was cool.
So I actually got to meet on the phone Steve Jobs when he destroyed the company. This new company, he was not acting CEO at that point. The head of the App Store was there with us when we were talking. And they said, we're going to have to make it so you don't make more apps for bands. And our answer was, why? This is amazing. All the bands want them. And their answer was, at that point, we had more apps under development for bands than they had other apps in the App Store. And the response from the executives at Apple was, we do not want our App Store to be a social network. We want an app. You can make a network app for all the bands to be on one app, and you can go to that page. Spotify wound up doing that later, by side note. So this is what you're talking about. Don't build your house on somebody else's property. Yeah. Apple had the ability to shut down that company at a whim by saying, that's not the direction we want to go. And they have that same power this entire time with Facebook. They were getting a lot of revenue from Facebook for those ads. Eventually, they said they would lose more revenue in the lawsuits over privacy than they were making from Facebook over the ads. And so they said, no, Facebook, you can't do this anymore. And Mark Zuckerberg and the rest of the executives at Facebook were just as shocked as my brother, your son, and I were sitting at that conversation. You can do that? Well, yeah, it's their house. They own the property. They get to say no. There might be antitrust rules about it, but nothing on this level. Facebook really can't sue Apple on this. They're protecting the privacy of their users.
Yep. And there you go. Let me go to the other side of that story. We said that Meta, formerly known as Facebook, experienced the largest dollar value drop in a single day in the history of the market. Now, the next day, Amazon did the reverse and experienced the largest dollar value rise in the history of the market. And there's a reason that the two went in opposite directions. Amazon, when it came out, for a long time, was very, very dependent on two things: the United States Postal Service and then UPS and later FedEx. But they were basically dependent upon other corporations for their success. And if UPS made, by the way, UPS just made a pivot this last week. I think they announced that they are going to start looking at, instead of increasing the volume they're delivering, they've backed off and said, let's look at the profitability of the delivering we're doing and go more B2B. If Amazon was still in a position where they were totally dependent on UPS to deliver their stuff, they would be in a world of hurt right now.
Yeah.
Instead, you will notice, in the recent past, at least in my experience, the number of times you get a delivery from Amazon and it says on the side of the van, Amazon as opposed to UPS, has gone up dramatically.
Right. And that's a supply chain issue that happened before the supply chain issue. Right. They made a really good decision at the depths of the pandemic, when a lot of people were out of work, to hire a bunch of them. which is why a lot of the other folks can't find people to hire because Amazon grew.
And they bought a lot of vans at the right time. The bottom line to it is Amazon was smart enough to realize that their house was built on somebody else's property.
Yeah.
And we're running out of time, but we also, one last thing, in our business, we made a decision a number of years ago, what, about 20 years ago, to no longer rent a building to have our business in because we realized that our business could be put out of business by a landlord.
23 years ago. Yeah.
23 years ago. So 23 years ago, we bought a building and it's the same thing. And it's, if you think about that, that makes a lot of sense.
Right.
And we're about out of time.
That whole message is control your supply chain. That's really it. It's control your supply chain. And Facebook needs to be able to control people's access to Facebook. And if it's going through someone else's gate, somebody can close that gate.
Yep.
All right. So, yeah, we are about out of time this hour. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we have another hour coming up as well, so you don't need to leave. But if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have email addresses waiting. You can send to Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and you can sign up for newsletters, and you can go to any podcast provider you want to listen to podcasts. You can contact us through the contact form on the webpage. You can, all of our staff are on there. Our made for radio faces are appearing when you log into that site. I'm sorry. I know the EPA has been mad at us for scaring away the birds in the area just by walking around. So, if you want to contact us, that's the way to do it. We've got more, questions for next hour.
Yeah, Sonny, we'll be back with you next hour.
Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.